Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 16th of January. A couple of perspectives on Iraq, the first hour of our program today. We start with this news, which you probably heard, that the United Nations has a new report saying that more than 34,000 civilians were violently killed across Iraq last year, an average of 94 killed every day. The figures came on this day when there was a massive car bomb near a university in Baghdad, killing at least 38 Iraqis. The report said the situation is particularly grave in Baghdad and that sectarian violence, especially in Baghdad, is singled out as a major cause for an ever-growing trend in displacement and migration of all Iraqis, as well as the targeting of various professional groups, including educators, medical professionals, journalists, judges and lawyers, religious and political leaders. Will the president's new plan, the addition of 22,000 troops to Baghdad particularly, quell some of this violence? Going to have a couple of perspectives. It's been a little while since we've spoken with David Winston. David will be joining us the first half hour of this hour, president and founder of the Winston Group. Later this hour, Michael O'Hanlon, senior fellow foreign policy studies for the Brookings Institution, will join us. David has served as, he is president and founder of the Winston Group. He has served as senior leadership staff in Congress and as a senior fellow to a prominent Washington, D.C. think tank. He worked with former House Republican Conference Chair J.C. Watts for 4 years. And prior to that, he was the director of planning for the Speaker of the House, where he oversaw initiatives from education, taxes, Social Security, health care, and technology to the 21st Century Congress. He was a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He was an adjunct professor at the Communications College at American University and has lectured at MIT, Georgetown, William & Mary, George Washington University, and the National War College. He also teaches campaign strategy at the Campaign Management Institute at American University. He's with us right now. And we should also say, we like to say this, that he is married to Chris Winston, the first and only woman to head the Office of Speech Writing for a President of the United States, and she did so under George Bush Sr. Our number, as we talk about Iraq again today, because it is a big story and many of you will want to join the conversation, I'm sure, 800-486-8655. Hello, David. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. It just shows you that you live long enough, you can have a long resume.
And I only read part of it, David, so so you're older than you think.
Yeah, no, thanks. Maybe not a Happy New Year. I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah. Let me ask you this first. We've been trying to figure out here why it is that the president went the route that he went, considering the election, considering the fact that a number of Republicans are pretty nervous about adding more troops. A lot of Joint Chiefs of Staff said they we don't like this policy. Why is he going this route, do you think?
Well, I think he first off, he clearly believes that there's a way to success in Iraq, and he thinks he has that. Secondly, and I think sort of more difficultly, and I think this is a problem that everybody's trying to think through, is he can't envision what happens if we don't succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens after Iraq? Let's assume for the moment we did redeployment or whatever. What would then happen? Does that mean that that Al-Qaeda tries to reengage the Taliban in Afghanistan? Does that mean they try to do something in Pakistan? And then the idea that they have potentially a country from which to operate from, in this case Iraq, with some resources and infrastructure, my sense is where he's coming from is, I just can't let that happen. We've got to figure out some way to make Iraq succeed. And my sense is the Democrats' point of view is, we've gone beyond that point. We don't see how that's going to happen, so let's get to that next stage. And the president just is unwilling at this point to say success can't happen.
Yeah, what do you think?
I think it's difficult at this point. I think it's been several years in terms of this discussion about the need for more troops. I think that this was probably needed back then. I don't have, obviously, the operational knowledge of what's going on the ground and what's potentially successful or not. I do think that he is taking a risk here in terms of this last effort, particularly given what the last election said. But that's his role as president. And if he feels that it could succeed, and you're seeing some people sort of saying, okay, one more chance.
Right.
There's some who are saying that.
Right.
Let me rephrase that. And there are others who say that we just have to sort of get to the next stage of this conflict with Al-Qaeda.
Yeah. I mean, the figure that I read at the top of the show is quite sobering, isn't it, David? 34,000 civilians violently killed last year across Iraq. That's a huge number of people.
Now, and I think what you're clearly beginning to see, and this is the difficulty with the present government, is, look, the one thing that all governments need to provide is that sense of personal safety and security.
Yes.
I mean, you go back to the security mom in the 2002 election. You know, it's very similar there. I mean, if there's not a sense that they're going to be safe and secure, that government is going to be remarkably unstable.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, they think that this is going to work in terms of at least dealing with the violence in Baghdad, or they hope it'll work. Maybe better ways of phrasing it. But if in fact they're unable to stop that huge number occurring this year, I mean, this government is going to have serious difficulties. This government being the present Iraqi Maliki government.
Right. What do you think of him? Do you think he's an up in front kind of guy? Do you think that he's going to help us here or not?
I don't know enough to give you an answer like that. I mean, he's clearly in a horrible situation, right? And he's in the midst of. I mean, how long has the conflict between Shia and Sunni gone on? I mean, this is not just something that just popped up. I mean, this is obviously something that's been a key element of the area for a long time. He's dealing with a difficult situation. And at this point, you know, when you look at that number from last year, it hasn't been particularly effective in the way he's been dealing with it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so I guess it's one of those things, being a numbers guy, you look at the numbers, and the number you quoted, the 34,000, shows, at least at this point, whatever he's been trying has not been successful.
Right. The vice president over the weekend said that the Democrats, let's switch to them for a moment, have nothing to offer in the place of what the president has offered. He said, I have yet to hear a coherent policy from the Democratic side. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. At this point, because what the Democrats are not doing, and by the way, as quick as that, I mean, this is a tough situation. To come up with any policy, given what the limited options are, is difficult. So while I would agree that they don't have one, I think that's because there's not a whole lot to choose from either. I don't think what the Democrats are addressing here is, okay, if you do this redeployment, and let's say... and you now create this infrastructure out of Iraq for Al-Qaeda, and then they decide to go reestablish the Taliban in Afghanistan, are we willing to crank up the number of troops we have in Afghanistan to 75,000? Is that where Al-Qaeda is going to go next? Maybe Al-Qaeda decides to go instead, goes to Jordan or Lebanon or directly to Pakistan. At some point in time, this doesn't end the war on terror. This just means we're going to fight it in a different location.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you address that? What's your strategy to deal with that? And you've heard some try to address the situation in terms of ideas, in terms of Joe Biden, his idea of sort of segmenting Iraq into three different countries for the Kurds, Sunni and Shia. But overall, there's not been a coherent response. But I think you're seeing some fracturing in terms of where to go, not merely in terms of just the Democratic Party, but the Republican Party as well. You've heard some voices within the Republican Party not being sure in terms of what direction we should go as well.
Yeah. What about the American people? What do you think they want?
They want success, okay, on the war on terror. They support this idea of democracy in Iraq. They're just not, and so the basic strategy, when the president sort of reiterates that, they agree with that part. What they don't understand is how's it going to be achieved. And nice idea, but they're not sure it can get done. And that's why the whole, and we've talked about this before in previous conversations, why the concept of benchmarks is so important, and clear benchmarks, so that people can follow whether things are succeeding or not succeeding.
Mm-hmm.
Saying we're going to establish democracy in Iraq is not a benchmark, it's a strategy. Saying that, okay, we've got these four sections of the city, And this is how you're going to know that we are in control of the area. And so, for the example, might be we're going to limit the number of, and I'm not saying this is a real number, but just as an example, we're going to limit the number of deaths per week to 20 in Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then people following it can at least say, okay, are we succeeding or not succeeding? But one of the problems that I think we've seen in terms of as this policy has evolved, and my guess is most of your listeners have no idea what to follow to understand whether things are going to be a success or not.
Yes.
And the only number they've had as a result is the number that actually you gave, and that is how many deaths this week.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a valid point, that we do need some benchmark of success here. And the president didn't really outline that. He said that the Iraqi government would have to meet up to their responsibility, but we're not sure what everybody's job is supposed to be here.
Right, and I think everybody out there would agree, yes, we want to see the Iraqi government stuff. Okay, so if I'm watching this as an average citizen to understand how this policy is working, what am I supposed to look for to see that's happening and it's being successful? And I would suggest that people don't have that. They don't know what to look for.
Right. We had Professor Bruce Ackerman with us yesterday who suggested this, which I hadn't heard before. Tell me what you think. He said, and he's opposed, as you would imagine, to an escalation here. He's opposed to the venture in the first place, that what Congress needs to do is set a price tag on the long-run cost of the war, say $500 billion was his figure, and tell the president that he won't be getting a penny more.
I think at this point, I'm not sure that I agree with that. I understand what he's trying to get at. He's trying to sort of have Congress sort of put some parameters in terms of what the president can do or not do. I think at this point, because we're dealing with how do we win the war on terror, I just think that what needs to occur here is a discussion of how do we win the war on terror. Is Iraq recoverable or not? And if it is, how do we do that, which is what the president is trying to say. If it isn't, which is where I think the Democrats are going, okay, then what are we going to do in the next phase in terms of how do we manage when al-Qaeda goes into another country?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's got to be the discourse. But, I know he's trying to arbitrarily put a number on this, but what happens when you get to $500 billion and you've almost won? You know, I mean, you're not going to spend the next 50?
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of, and I think what he's trying to get at is the Congress has to play a role. Its role is through the purse, and it needs to be engaged in this discussion. I think you're going to see the Democrats do that in the House and the Senate.
And what's your best assessment on this? And at what point can we assess this, David, as to whether or not we've almost won? How are we going to know when we've won? Can we win, do you think, at this point?
And now you've gotten into sort of a real theoretical discussion that I'm sure at a lot of the sort of, you know, like national war colleges and places like that are trying to think through how do you define victory in an environment where you've got terrorists that you might not see them for 2 years and then suddenly they pop up and do something. And I think that's part of what this administration's got to work through so it can define to people so they can sort of see success. And again, I go back to this benchmark thing, what's going on in Iraq. There's not a definition for people to understand, but also in terms of what success is, but also the broader war on terror, how do we succeed? You know, there's one level here that, you know, clearly we haven't been attacked, and that's certainly a good sign, and you would argue that would be a point of success. But how do you then deal with what's occurring in Pakistan, what's occurring in Afghanistan? It's complex. And part of what needs to happen here, and this is what I think has sort of been unfortunate from both sides, and that is there needs to be sort of a consensus in terms of the country of here's the direction we need to go. And I think we've lost that a bit. Mm. And I think one of the things that we need to see, hopefully see over the next couple of years, is the two sides that have come together and say, okay, here's the direction we want to go. Unfortunately, I think that's probably a little ways off.
We're speaking the first half hour with David Winston, president of the Winston Group, welcoming phone calls for him at 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David Winston, our guest, the first half hour of this program, and let's go to phone calls. Dan from Madison is our first caller. David, hello, Dan.
Hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I don't believe that the American people are all so taken in by ridiculous definitions of success as defined by the likes of the neocons. A success would be an immediate implementation of a workable exit strategy, because this Iraq war, as last year's National Intelligence Estimate informed the nation, has become the greatest engine driving terrorism probably in U.S. history. And apart from that, the United States is inflicting a whole lot of terrorism on innocent people who never did us any harm, who never possessed the means to threaten us or harm us in any way. And these ideas of we should get the heck out of Iraq and offer them substantial reparations for destroying their country. And that'll go a long way in lessening the worldwide threat of terror.
All right, let's address the first point, David. Do you think our actions have fueled terrorism?
I think it's focused terrorism in Iraq. I mean, look, terrorism clearly existed prior to that. I mean, 9/11 occurred before we were in Iraq, and so Al Qaeda was clearly a functioning and efficient organization by that point prior to Iraq. Going to what Dan said in terms of the problem is there haven't been any definitions of success. Mm-hmm. I mean, people have said the word, but people haven't understood what it meant nor understood how we get there. And so it isn't that people have sort of put out ridiculous versions of it. It's that they've just never been defined, so people didn't know how to grapple with that. Going to the last point in terms of reparations, which I have to say that for obvious reasons I disagree. I don't think we're inflicting terrorism on that country. I mean, I think Saddam Hussein did a pretty decent job all by his lonesome in terms of doing that and getting rid of him, you know, no matter what, was still a plus. But I do think what you're seeing, and part of the shift in this policy, is doing things like there's $1 billion for a jobs program. There's this real focus on rebuilding infrastructure and really trying to get the economy of Iraq sort of up and running in a way that will create a positive environment. And so I think you're seeing that as a key next step. Whether that's successful or not, we'll see.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to David from Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, David.
Good morning, Kathleen, and good morning, David.
Good morning.
I can't find words to express the contempt I have for the Bush administration, but I'm finding room for a little contempt for the Democrats who I have voted for almost all of my life. I'm 71 years old. Their timidity in putting a stop to this horror just there's really no excuse for, and I understand that they're concerned about having Bush pin the tail on their donkey and make this their war. But I heard a comment just a few minutes ago, I don't know who you were quoting, that someone had suggested that Congress perhaps give them a $500 billion limit and tell them no more after that.
It was yesterday's guest.
We're somewhere between $350 and $400 billion now. And I thought of an analogy of a family member who has an alcohol problem, and perhaps I could tell them, we will buy you another 50 cases of beer, and after that, you're all done. And that's what's going on here. We keep feeding this insane addiction that we have to throwing good money after bad and throwing good bodies into graves and throwing people into hospitals. And I can't say any more. Heart rate is exceeding its limit.
Thank you, Dave, for your call. David?
I think one of the things clearly facing the Democratic leadership is specifically that choice, and there has been clear discussion been going on in terms of, actually I would suggest that maybe sooner than $500 billion, that since Congress controls the power of the purse, and that's obviously money is needed to continue this war, what exactly is the Democratic leadership in the House and the Senate going to do? And again, I think what's occurring here is, given that the president is saying, here's this one last strategy, the debate is, do we give him this last direction, and then we do what we want to do, or do we just simply come in and, given what happened in terms of the election, say, look, enough, and here's the direction we're going to go, and we control the purse so we can define this. That's a debate that I think you're going to see evolve over the next month or so, and it's a real critical debate, and you have lots of people like David who clearly voted for Democrats to specifically cut off the purse. But again, we'll see what happens in terms of how this debate unfolds over the next month or two.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that part of it, David, is just a matter of finding, and you talked about this a little bit earlier, that you just, after you've put all of these people there, and if you believe, if you're the president, if you really believe in this strategy, that admitting that it's not going well and that you can't get yourself out of this in some way that makes you feel good, you just can't do it. You just can't admit it to yourself, even though it's probably not very winnable. Success is not very achievable.
Well, I think there are two elements to this. One, obviously this president, and you saw him the other day at the when he awarded the Medal of Honor to the one soldier who died, and his parents were there, and mm-hmm. obviously a very emotional thing for the president. So the idea that he understands the sacrifice that's been made is clear, and doesn't want to sort of leave after this huge sacrifice being made, wants to have some sort of success, sort of understandable. Having said that, there's got to be sort of an objective view of can we succeed or not.
Right.
And I think you're going to see that debate occur over the next month or two. But there's another element here, too, that I'd like to sort of stress here, and that is getting out of Iraq doesn't end the situation in terms of the war on terror. I mean, it's going to come up somewhere else. And so part of what has to sort of go into this is, okay, if we can't do it in Iraq, we know it's going to come up somewhere else. So how are we going to manage the next one? And that's the other difficulty here. It is not just Iraq. It's the whole broader war on terror. Where would we go next, and how would we manage that? And I'm not sure people have really thought that through either yet as well.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Tom. Where are you from, Tom?
Sabisky.
Oh, Sabisky. Hi, Tom.
Hi. My comment is I think it's time for the U.S. to get out of Iraq, minimize the forces, pull back to Afghanistan, let the cream of the cream come and start seeing what happens. You know, I don't think Maliki really has the power to do what he's supposed to be doing. And let the real, true leaders step forth. Democracy doesn't work in Iraq. They don't have the same investment that our forefathers had. And then once the true leaders in Iraq would come forth, if we don't like them, we reenter Iraq instead of just throwing money out there. And then the other thing is if we do pull back, let the businessmen start infiltrating and taking it over.
David.
Well, I think Tom hits on obviously the key conflict in terms of what's more important to the people in Iraq. I mean, I think there was this initial interest in democracy, and what's sort of evolved here is what's more important to Iraqis, democracy or the sort of Sunni-Shia conflict? I mean, the sort of long-term cultural conflict. And unfortunately, it's really unclear which one's more important at this point. And certainly in terms of what gets covered, the Shia-Sunni conflict is covered a lot more. So I think Tom is on the money there that's a real important distinction. Having said that, again, pulling back and letting Iraq resolve itself is one part of the dynamic that would occur. The other thing that would clearly occur is that you would now have infrastructure and resources for al-Qaeda in Iraq to then potentially go somewhere else. Now the thing is, if we can't succeed, then that's just an outcome, right, that the United States can't deal with. I mean, they can't oppose because Iraq would clearly evolve that way. But once that infrastructure is in place, it will emerge in other countries. So pulling back to Afghanistan, maybe they decide to go to Jordan. Okay, what do we do about that? And again, that's part of this sort of long-term planning that we need to begin to think through as we look at the implications of what's occurring in Iraq and what our options are there.
David, thank you so much for being with us.
No, my pleasure.
Always a pleasure. David Winston, our guest, the first part of this hour, president and founder of the Winston Group. He has worked with former House Republican Conference Chair J.C. Watts. He was Director of Planning for the Speaker of the House and a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Also, he has taught and teaches campaign strategy at the Campaign Management Institute at American University. And, well, that's just part of his resume. We're going to continue our conversation, different guest with a different analysis of Iraq. The number 800-486-8655. Michael O'Hanlon is with us now. Michael of the Brookings Institution and author of the recent book, Hard Power, The Politics of National Security. I don't know if you saw The New Yorker this week, but he was mentioned saying that the Bush administration incompetence, not Democratic foreign policy wisdom, accounts for the Democrats' success in last November's midterm election without answers of their own to the questions they posed to the Bush administration about how to keep the country safe and secure. Democrats are likely to find current gains in national polls to be fleeting or illusory. Michael has special expertise in Asian security issues, homeland security, Iraq policy, military technology, missile defense, North Korea policy, peacekeeping operations. He's senior fellow foreign policy studies, Sidney Stein chair at the Brookings Institution, also is a visiting lecturer at Princeton University, and is the author of a number of books. And we'll be welcoming phone calls for him, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, 227-2050, if you're joining us in Milwaukee, 227-2050. Michael, hello. Thanks very much for being with us. Hi.
Nice to be with you.
Nice to have you here. You know, I want you to start with this number because this just knocked me out this morning when I heard it. 34,000 civilians violently killed across Iraq last year. 34,000 people?
I think that's the right ballpark. I think that you can get estimates that are anywhere from half that to five times that, but yeah, I think that is the right ballpark. And that, to my mind, pretty much puts to rest the debate over whether Iraq is in civil war. There are various definitions of the term, but when you're at that sheer level of violence, it's pretty hard to get away from the commonsensical argument that, yes, it's in civil war because the sheer amount of internal killing is just so great.
Exactly. And so you look at that in context of sending 22,000 troops, and you've got to think, is that going to do it? Is that going to turn the tide here?
Well, my argument is that it's not that likely to, but I still think it's slightly more promising than existing policy. And I am not one of the people who thinks that we can easily just withdraw and give up and let what happens come what will in Iraq. I think we have to manage whatever chaos ensues. And therefore, at the margin, I am reluctantly a supporter of the president's plan, even though it would have been much better 3 years ago. But with the caveat that I don't necessarily think the chances are all that high it's going to work. And so we better be focusing very hard on developing a backup plan, even as we think about implementing this. And I think the backup plan may be needed in the course of 2007.
And the backup plan, what's going through your mind for a backup plan?
Well, the Bosnia model is the shorthand. A guy named Ed Joseph, who's a Bosnia expert, and I have been writing about this. And the basic idea, which builds on Senator Biden's proposal, is that Iraq would essentially become three autonomous regions. There would still be enough of a federal government to share oil revenue equally and have, you know, border controls and some small national army. But basically, you would have Shia governing and policing Shia, Sunnis doing the same for their own people, and the Kurds, who already are effectively autonomous, continuing on as they have been. You'd have to have some kind of a mechanism for resolving disputed borders and areas. But to the extent the oil was shared equally, I think it would minimize the, or at least reduce the danger of some of the flash points turning into conflict zones. And then you would use U.S. forces, who would have to remain in some numbers, largely to police these internal boundaries across the autonomous regions and more or less allow the Sunnis, as I say, to police themselves and the Shia to police themselves. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the kind of an idea that, frankly, not only makes sense and would be better than complete chaos, but frankly is already beginning to happen on the ground because 100,000 people per month are being displaced from their homes in ethnic cleansing. Mm-hmm. Iraq is becoming Bosnia. And in a sense, I think the sooner we recognize that and try to negotiate and manage that process, the better, because otherwise the alternative is going to be increasing ethnic cleansing.
What are these troops supposed to do in Baghdad? They don't speak Arabic. What are they supposed to do? They're going from house to house, knocking down the doors, and what happens then?
Well, the knocking down the doors part is something that
I think they will try to minimize. Dave Petraeus, as you know, General Petraeus is going over to Iraq to run the show. He was just in charge of producing the Army's counterinsurgency manual that I would recommend people at least to skim to get a feel for where he comes from. And the basic notion, you know, I think chapter one in that has a nice table of some basic truisms about proper counterinsurgency doctrine, such as sometimes using less force is more effective, and trying to minimize the number of victims you create is also important because it reduces the number of future enemies you're going to create as you do your policing. So I don't think Petraeus is going to be a big proponent of knocking down doors, but every so often, of course, you're going to have to when you get fired upon or when you get good intelligence about the location of a weapons cache or a headquarters for an insurgent group or a militia. It's going to be tough, though, because they can't really afford to provoke too many of these confrontations, or they are going to wind up creating more enemies than they are able to take out of business. And so that's one of the reasons why I think at this late hour, the chances for success are relatively mediocre. Now, we are, as you know, going to partner with Iraqi units more and more, and that could help with some of the language issue. On the other hand, it's not that easy to partner with people whose loyalties may be more to their own ethnic group than to the nation, and who have been reluctant to do many of the things we wanted in the past. So I think my expectations here are that we're going to struggle and maybe have some limited successes, but probably not achieve the outcome we really are after.
So then we go to the Bosnia model?
That's what I think. Obviously, it depends on the Iraqis agreeing, and Iraq's a sovereign country, and there's no way this can work without the Iraqis agreeing to it, because otherwise, you know, they will fight over each and every inch of land and oil producing zone that we can possibly imagine, you know, doing a soft partition over. So we're going to have the Iraqis buying into it. And right now they don't. Right now the Kurds might, but and Mr. Hakim, who recently met with President Bush from one of the main Shia parties, he might. But most of the other Iraqi groups have not yet reconciled themselves with this notion, and perhaps they never will. There are some people who say it's just a flat-out bad idea, but frankly, I think, again, that's where realities on the ground are moving already, and pretty soon it's going to be a choice between, if we leave things as they are, continuing on with more of the same versus just leaving entirely, and I don't think either one of those options is very good. So unless there's a better plan B, I'm going to be solidly behind this Bosnia concept.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about why the president has decided to go this course, considering the fact that the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that many of his military commanders before we got new guys in there, the American people, a lot of Republicans, the Iraq Study Group, everybody's recommending something different. Why do you think he chose this course, and why is it that this course, do you think, might be slightly more promising than any other course?
Well, I'm not here to defend the president's plan, and I don't think he's done a great job with this issue. But I still would, yeah, at the margin, say it's probably a bit more promising than the Iraq Study Group. Let me give a couple of reasons why. One, the Iraq Study Group seemed to really make a big emphasis on regional negotiation with Iran and Syria. Mm-hmm. I think there is a value to that negotiation, but I don't expect it's going to make a huge difference. The Iraqis are pretty capable of having this civil war without much outside help. And even though I think Iran in particular has been unhelpful, to use a Rumsfeldism, it's not necessarily the main cause of the violence. So you go in to talk to Iran, not because you think you can radically turn things around, but hoping for at least a little marginal benefit. And if nothing else, forcing the Iranians to clarify in front of the eyes of the region and the world that they have no particular interest in helping us in Iraq, which may turn out to be the case. So I think that proposal from the Iraq Study Group was it sounded a little too optimistic that you could really make big progress through regional diplomacy. Also, the idea of getting our combat forces entirely out of Iraq by 2008, I thought was a good idea, sort of as a threat to the Iraqis, that we will do this if you don't get your act together. But if they do try harder to get their act together, I think for us to leave entirely by 2008 or to pull all of our combat forces out by then would essentially condemn them to a worsening civil war, because I don't think their institutions are going to be strong enough to handle the problem on their own by then.
Yeah.
And so that's why, in the end, unless you've already concluded that we've basically lost, that I think the Iraq Study Group didn't have enough of an element of conditionality. Now, it did sort of say, yeah, we could stay a little longer, help a little more if they cooperate, but in the end, it really wanted to get the combat forces out by next year, and I think that's probably too soon. Sure, it'd be nice to be well underway with a drawdown by next year,
but I don't think it's realistic to think we can be all the way out.
Why is it so hard to get these Iraqi forces to do their job? We've been there 4 years now. What do they need? They need 8 years? They need 6 years? What do they need?
Well, you ask a good question. That's a very fair point. I think they need, you know, in terms of the technical skills they're acquiring, they need a couple more years. But a more difficult challenge than that is the commitment of these forces to the idea of an integrated, cohesive Iraqi state rather than to fighting for their own sectarian interests. Because, as you know, many of the units are predominantly one ethnic group or another, and they show more loyalty to their own people or to their own sectarian group than to the Iraqi nation right now, for the most part. And I think the only way, therefore, that you can get the Iraqi security forces to perform better is if the Iraqi political leadership really creates the notion of an Iraq that's serving everyone's interests. So, in other words, it has to begin with politics. It has to begin with the Iraqi leaders reaching across the sectarian divide on issues like sharing oil revenue equally among all Iraqis, on issues like allowing former Ba'athists, at least the lower-level ones who were not close associates of Saddam and do not have blood on their own hands, allowing them to be rehabilitated, essentially, so they can compete for jobs and rejoin public life. Those sorts of decisions are going to have to be made and acted upon quickly. Or there's no way that the Sunnis in particular will be supportive of the idea of a new Iraqi state, and therefore no way that you will stop the insurgency, and therefore no way that you will stop the Shia militias, because the militias are largely responding to the insurgency and retaliating against them. So that's the dynamic. You got to start with politics, or there really is, in my judgment, no real hope of getting the security forces to perform better.
We're going to welcome phone calls from Michael. Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow Foreign Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution and co-author of Hard Power, The New Politics of National Security. Our phone number, our lines are busy right now with people wanting to talk to Michael, but there will be some openings. So here's the number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, Robert Stone will be with us. Robert is the acclaimed author of a number of novels. This book is titled Prime Green. It's getting a lot of attention, Remembering the 60s. So he talks about Ken Kesey and Jack Kerouac and drugs during the 60s and politics. He also reported for some time from Vietnam. He worked with Manhattan tabloids. He's had a very, very interesting life. So Robert Stone joining us the second hour. All right, let's go to phone calls now from Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow at Foreign Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution. And we go to John from Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hi. I was trying to think of some statistics that would put into perspective the amount of money that we spent. And one of the statistics that I thought of that probably would make even a hardcore conservative flinch is that if you take $400 billion, there's only 7 million families in Iraq. And if you divide 7 million into 400 billion, we have spent enough money to give every family in Iraq $60,000. We could have built every single family in Iraq a new home with the money that we have spent to destroy the country. We're not done. We still have probably another $400 billion to spend. I think you should ask your wife to talk to the president and ask him, how much more do we have to spend? Do we have to spend $100,000 for every single Iraqi family? Do you think they would like us a lot more if we gave each family a new home?
Michael.
Great perspective. Uh-huh. We have put an enormous amount of resources into this effort, and even in terms of the economic aid alone, and the caller was very rightly combining the economic aid with the military expense, and of course the latter is the predominant piece, but even with the economic piece, if you just focus on that, we have now essentially had a Marshall Plan for Iraq. If you adjust for inflation and the size of Iraq, we've essentially pumped as much money into that country as we did into Western Europe after World War II.
Goodness.
And it hasn't made any real difference. So, you know, I think it was a very powerful point, and I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah. Thanks, John, for your powerful point, and he's made many of them over the years. We appreciate your call. We go next to Dale from River Falls. Hello, Dale.
Hey, good morning.
Hi.
I'm wondering what your guests might have to say about what the Democrats are supposed to do. It seems like they've been painted into a corner by the Republicans, and it's no matter what we do, it's a no-win situation if they don't let the president's plan go forward and see if it fails. The president and the Republicans will criticize them. If they come up with a new plan that doesn't work, then then they've got the bag in their hands.
Well, my response would be essentially what I wrote in a little column in the Washington Post Sunday, which is advice to the country, but also advice to the Democrats. I think the surge strategy, however mediocre its prospects, is worth trying for a few months, in part because even its proponents acknowledge that it should, if it works, show some promise within a few months. We should be able to measure the progress in terms of Iraqi government forces performing better and going to the places they haven't so far, in terms of the security environment at least beginning to improve in that period of time. And if not, then I think we should have used the intervening time, starting right now, to develop a plan B. And my plan B, as I just mentioned, is this Bosnia model. But even if you don't like mine, let's agree that the country should be focusing now on how we can settle for lower ambitions in Iraq, preferably without having to abandon the place to complete all-out civil war and regional chaos. And then let's be willing, as Democrats or as independents or anybody, to put pressure on Mr. Bush to basically say, okay, Mr. President, we're giving you one last shot, and we don't think it should take that long to know if your plan's working. And if it doesn't, we're going to demand a change starting in fiscal year 2008. So I propose that by October 1st, the beginning of 2008 in the fiscal context, the Congress should be willing to start to cut back on funding if we haven't seen any progress by then, and essentially view the next 6 months as Mr. Bush's last best chance.
Mm. And yet you're taking such a risk here, aren't you, Michael? Even the president admitted to the fact that this could be bloody, it could be violent. Don't you need a pretty good idea of whether or not this is going to work before you put so many American soldiers in harm's way and before you can maybe increase the number of Iraqi civilians who have been killed? This is big stuff.
Well, I don't know that the Iraqi civilians are going to become in any greater danger because of this plan. I do acknowledge that American troops will become in somewhat greater danger, not so much because of the increase in numbers. After all, we've had surges of roughly this size before. We just didn't have a big national debate about it. But we, you know, at the time of elections in Iraq in previous winters, we had temporary increases up to 160,000, 165,000 American troops, comparable to what we're now proposing. The bigger change is that these troops will now be patrolling more, living more in smaller outposts among Iraqis, and therefore less protected in their large fortifications and their large bases. And that is a risk, and I think we have to keep a close eye on what's going on there. But, you know, we've been losing 70 to 100 Americans a month now for 4 years. And so the idea that we're somehow in a relatively safe approach that offers us any kind of hope, I would not agree with. I think that the current policy is failing, and in that sense, it's easier to conclude we should try something else because what we're doing now just ain't working.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Lynn next from Rushford, Minnesota. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. I guess this is a numbers question. We seem to be expecting an awful lot from a country we've basically bombed to a fare-thee-well and have kept the screws to for the past 15 years. How is the Iraqi government supposed to step up to the plate, so-called, when so many of its men are dead? I suppose these were soldiers who would have provided the strength to carry out any government return to normalcy, much like our own National Guard would be expected to do. I just don't get the numbers thing. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's a good point because, leave aside, you're right, certainly, that America has caused some damage to Iraq over the years, but Saddam caused far more. And now the last 4 years of insurgency and civil war, which we obviously bear some responsibility for, have caused considerable additional damage. And you're right to focus on the numbers of able and talented Iraqis who have been killed or fled the country or otherwise no longer been available to help build this new nation. One of the things we keep in this Iraq Index, the statistical compendium we do at Brookings on the Internet, is we have tracked the number of physicians who have left Iraq or been kidnapped or killed in the time since overthrow of Saddam in 2003, and it's about a third of the entire physician population.
Gee whiz.
And so that's the sort of thing that we obviously cannot see go on much longer. It's probably already beyond the point of no return, but we can't really expect Iraq to be able to build itself into a new nation if the good people are being killed and driven out in that way. That's one more reason why I think we're going to have to just accept lower aspirations pretty soon and go to this regional autonomy model.
What role for the Democrats in all of this debate right now? In terms of, you know, how they could be helpful and also in terms of what would help them politically, do you think?
Well, I'd love to see more people talk about this Bosnia model. Senator Biden's done a good job. He's probably, along with Leslie Galba, the Council on Foreign Relations, been the original proponent. Of course, Democrats, not that the Clinton administration distinguished itself in Bosnia, because a couple hundred thousand people died before we got a peace deal there. But in contrast to the first Bush administration, Clinton at least was willing to get involved and ultimately did help achieve a peace. And the peace has been durable in Bosnia. And I think that there is something to learn from that model. And it's something that Democrats have been paramount in implementing in the past. So I would suggest that this is a good sort of concept to flesh out. You have to figure out if you're going to move to this sort of arrangement. For example, how do you help Iraqis relocate? How do you, your first caller talked about building new housing and how much money has been spent and what could be done with it. I think there's a real case to be made that we should help Iraqis relocate to places they feel safer and help them with new housing and new jobs. It wouldn't require even the $60,000 the caller mentioned. It would require, in the context of the Iraqi economy, a few thousand dollars. But it's the sort of thing that's going to have to be seriously considered. And I believe it's very hard for President Bush to talk about this. A, of course, he is so committed to his existing policy. And B, as the American president, when he begins to talk about this sort of a backup plan, it sort of encourages people to give up on the current plan. So it's hard for him to be the main proponent of a Bosnia model until he has made it official American policy and the Iraqi government has made it official Iraqi policy. And therefore, the Democrats and other members of Congress have an opportunity here to help drive this part of the debate.
Thanks, Lynn, very much for your call. Let's go to J.D. next from Green Bay. Hi, J.D.
Good morning. I would like to use a common sense approach, not an expert approach. You know, seem like the government feel like the Iraqi people is too stupid to solve their own problem when that's where the beginning of life started at, in that vicinity according to the Bible. Therefore, they've been solving their problems for over 2,000 years without the interference of the United States. Now, my last point is this. Pride is the reason that we are there. Pride is the reason that we refuse to leave there because we don't want to be seen as defeated. But there's a saying, it take a man to walk away from a conflict, but it take a fool to stay there to keep it going on. Thank you very much, and everybody have a blessed day.
Thanks, J.D., for your call. Michael.
Well, I'm sure that pride factors into Bush administration thinking to some extent, but I think that there is a serious American strategic argument that we cannot afford to just walk away from Iraq. If we walk away from Iraq, the most likely outcome, I believe, is verging on or moving towards a Rwanda-style genocide. I think it would be worse than Bosnia. And I don't know how to predict that, of course. You can't prove that. But it would be somewhere between Bosnia and Rwanda in terms of what would happen to Iraq's own people. And then there's the danger of the Turks coming in to attack the Kurds. There's the danger of al-Qaeda moving into the west of Iraq and setting up a big sanctuary. And so while it may wind up being the only option we have, I think it would be a very, very regrettable option. And things could get a whole lot worse in Iraq. As bad as they are today, they could get a whole lot worse before they get better, both for the Iraqi people and for American strategic interests. So that's why I'm serious about thinking through this idea of a plan B, where our role would be less than it is today, and our ambitions would be less, but we'd still be trying to prevent an all-out civil war and an all-out genocide.
Do you think the administration has a plan B, Michael?
I think they're starting to think about it, yes. I don't think they have one fleshed out because they've been so bent on making sure that their plan A works. And, you know, there's a psychological problem, of course, for all of us, and presidents are not immune to this. If you're so absolutely committed to a plan A, it's pretty hard to get really focused on a backup option. But I think they're at least beginning to realize they have to.
We're running short on time. We have about a minute left. But Ron from Milwaukee, go ahead.
Plan A, plan B. it seems so difficult for the Bush administration to ever tell the truth about anything they're doing. And when they're finally caught and it's obvious that they're not doing what they say they're doing, they make up another lie. I'd like to know what you know about the the American bases that have been started, perhaps finished, around the oil wells in Iraq, and that that is plan C, D, E, and F, and no one's talking about it. It's the elephant in the room, and these 20,000 new soldiers are not actually there to man little outposts and provide security for Iraqis. They're there to help finish those bases. So that
all right, I need to hold you there. We have about 20 seconds. Michael?
Well, I think I take your point that we have some long-term strategic ambitions, and the Bush administration does too, but I do not think that's what the 20,000 troops are going to be used for. I think we'll see it before our eyes, that they are going to be patrolling and otherwise trying to provide security to Iraqis.
Oh, that was good. You did that in less than 20 seconds. Michael, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow Foreign Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution, author of the book, fairly recent, Hard Power, The Politics of National Security. And we thank him for being with us, as well as David Winston, who is president of the Winston Group. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. And to John Treader for on-air production here in Milwaukee. Copies of the show, call the radio store at 800-747-7444. The program number is 116-D, 116-D. We'll have news coming up from National Public Radio in just a few moments, and then we'll return with what I think should be a real interesting hour. So stay with us if you were alive during the 60s or you want to know some of what they were all about. That's coming up. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.